We're going to open the meeting for May 30th, 2017, for the Audit Committee. And we have two items on our agenda today: public hearings and possible work session on the first item, which is committee discussion of the suggested audit topics for the Secretary of State. So we'd love to invite the Secretary of State, anyone he would like to bring up. Welcome, Mr. Richardson.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson, Oregon Secretary of State, and I'm here with Kip Mimmett, who is the director of our Audits Division. And I'd like to begin by thanking you for the recommendations that you made in your May 16th letter of areas of interest for future audits. And just a, kind of an overview, the audit selection division or process, is we're still working on that. Mr. Mimmett is bringing a lot of experience from what has really worked well in other states and other jurisdictions. And so he'll be talking to you a moment about risk assessment. But we are looking for, we get information from the whistleblowers, from the general public, from JLAC, this committee, and your recommendations, and from the auditors as they perform audits, become aware of other information which needs a further look. And so those all bring to us topics for audit. We truly believe that we are a team to help serve the people. And understanding the limited capacity of information on that audits can develop for the legislature, whatever we can do to help provide information that will enable the representatives of the people to evaluate budgets and to ask the questions that need to be asked for accountability by the state agencies, we want to be able to provide that information as well. So I'm grateful for your patience with me as I learn my duties, and I am so grateful that we have Kip Mimmett here, because he has brought a wealth of experience which will help our audits division.
Thank you, Secretary Richardson, members of the committee. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me back. I guess my first appearance was okay. Just want to kind of echo what the Secretary said. First and foremost, very pleased with your activity and your interest in audit. As I was talking to Representative McLean before, you know, just
state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's my fault. I should have said, could we have your name for
I
the record,
I should have known
please?
That. This is not my first
This
audio.
Is like the first time that I remembered to say it.
For the record, my name is Kip Mimmett. I'm the audit director for the Secretary of State's office. And I just wanted to echo a few of the comments that the Secretary just relayed to you guys, that risk assessment is a very important function of audit. How do we get to audit what we're auditing? You know, that's the $1 million question. We guess ask that all the time. And if you don't answer it the right way, you know, then other things outside of professional work kind of can play into that. So one thing that we're going to be doing working over the summer is our risk assessment process. That's how we, you know, based on our resources and projections and you know, how much time we have to get work done, we'll get a population of audits that we're going to do. Certainly be considering these, which, by the way, just for what it's worth, at a high level, are all great topics. Mm-hmm. There's audit risk here. Some of them are pretty broad, so I was hoping maybe we can just, if there's a Q&A, get a little bit deeper into sort of what specifically you may be looking for in those audits. But as a definite takeaway from this meeting, coming back in the September timeframe with our audit plan, mm-hmm. briefing you on the audit plan, including our risk assessment process, how we got things on there, what audits are actually on there and why, and kind of just having that discussion at that time. But we're just sort of, with some moving parts, and this is when we would start getting the risk assessment process underway anyway, so we're not behind or anything, but it is a bunch of new players in this organization, so we want to make sure we're all on the same page and have the same methodology going forward. Mm-hmm. But one last point that I want to make is, you know, one thing, I have this whole diatribe on how auditors have missed with risk assessment, and that we spend lots of resources trying to quantify subjective material. Mm-hmm. And often those numbers are confusing and people don't understand, and they're kind of written for auditors. And often they're developed in kind of auditor vacuums. And sometimes they miss the mark of the people they're working for. And they're not part of the risk assessment process. So part of my philosophy and strategy is always to reach out to the decision makers and policymakers as a top criteria. As a professional member, what I'm committed to doing is, hey, I think we have a better thing to do than count bus benches or whatever it may be, but make that professional argument on why we may want to use audit resources for another reason. But ultimately, you have to listen to the people that were elected by the citizens and be responsive to them. So, like I say, not only will we be this one time soliciting your feedback on audit work, but we will be doing that going forward. That's all I have.
Are there questions for our panel? Co-Chair Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Secretary of State. In our audit request letter, we listed four particular requests, but we listed two as being ones that we had at the highest level of our level of request. And I just wanted to put on record on one of those why I believe it's very important. The Department of Revenue is experiencing some difficulties, some internal difficulties. And if the Secretary of State would remember from his days on Ways and Means as we took people through phase one, phase two, and then phase three, our subcommittee on general government has spent more time on the Department of Revenue than they probably have on everything else combined, actually. So there are just some very significant issues there, and we were particularly troubled by the customer satisfaction numbers from the department. And it's not so much that when someone interacts with the Department of Revenue that they're going to be pleased by that interaction, but it's because it isn't just a recent phenomena. After, I think it's a period of almost like 4 years, the customer satisfaction numbers have gone down to some of the lowest I've seen for any state agency. And we really think it's probably incumbent on us to get to the bottom of that as sooner rather than later. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Other comments or questions for our panel? Would anybody like to talk a little bit more about some of the other suggestions from our letter, or to add a little detail, or as you were saying, maybe have a dialogue on specifically what we suggested, like the co-chair just did? Or any questions that you'd like to make of us?
Co-Chair McLean and Co-Chair Devlin, members of the committee, just a couple of things. One on the Department of Revenue audit. So one, I meant to say in my opening comments, we have already commenced the Gentax audit, their new IT system, so we already have that one underway. I like the other two topics. One is the outward-facing customer, and one is the inward-facing customer, their employee base. Slightly different methodologies to get to that, but that is a very interesting audit topic in terms of auditing culture. And there are some innovative things out there, so we'll consider that as we go forward. The Department of Education audit, I was just wondering, I talked to a couple of my staff trying to get some historical feel around this, and I wasn't quite sure exactly if there's a specific thing there we wanted to look at, or just sort of kind of the grant management that you were asking to look at.
I guess I could start a little with that. Some of the comments that were made to me when that suggestion or idea came up was the fact that because we've got a Department of Education that has a variety of grants, and we have a variety of grants that seem to have been siloed because of the way, you know, the funds and the requirements for the grants to be actually, you know, sort of a competitive grant versus a non-competitive grant, that they were asking if the administration was being siloed too in such a way that it was as effective on if we had a grant program that had maybe a combined administrative function, and that in some of those cases there was more of a committed function for administrative grants, maybe that were all competitive, or administrative, you know, grants that section that was non-competitive. And that they just wanted a review of specifically how effective the administration and the way the grants are actually laid out for schools to actually compete for, or at least have an opportunity to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And so just looking at the different structures within the Department of Education and how it was functioning, and how the different types of grants and different types of siloing of money or of administration affected the effectiveness or efficiency of the program.
members of the committee understood that. That clarifies a lot. And just so you know, our staff, you probably do know this, but we do a single audit. That's the federally required audit on all those grants. I mean, we sample them, but we have a great internal understanding of grants there. We probably just have not, to my knowledge, done a performance audit on the grant administration, more like a financial compliance. So my point being is we would have a lot of expertise to jumpstart on that one.
Mm-hmm. Any other member like to comment on any of the audits that we suggested in the letter?
Just
yes.
I'm sorry.
You were first, Senator. Representative, you were first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment on the grants and the education. I don't know why the bell just turned on me this session that I didn't realize that the Oregon grants, and we have some significant amounts of money for the Senate Bill 182 and 183. I didn't realize that's not money out there. That's taken off the top of the school fund, the grant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of these, you know, that's great. Let's do that. It's going to help education. But I didn't realize until this session I've learned that that's really coming out of the state school fund. So, you know, I hope that, you know, whether that's distributed, you know, that's, you know, the Constitution talks about that every student gets the same amount, and that's equity in our Constitution for education. So the urban and rural areas, and so that's something if you'd get into that audit and look at, I think it should look at as far as, you know, are we missing the boat here on the constitutional requirement, mm-hmm. and by establishing these grants, which is not really funded except by taking money away from each school.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
All right.
Now, Co-Chair Devlin.
The only other thing I was going to comment on is we did adopt one of your practices, and that is that we've started our own tracker for audit requests, just so that because we recognize your limited resources, so we can't forward everything to you that we get. And in fact, just as we were completing our work, we got another request for an audit. So we'll probably have to consider that and forward something to you in the fall if we decide to go ahead with a request in that particular area. But I'm anticipating as we improve this process that we will be getting more requests. The only real issue is going to be is how we're able, working with you, we're able to narrow those requests because we're still recognizing the limited resources you have actually to conduct the audits.
Co-Chair Devlin and Co-Chair McLean, members of the committee, it's an interesting experience for me to be learning on the aspects of selecting audits. We appreciate very much the recommendations you have, and you may want to not wait, but send us an email and say, might also consider this, and we'll talk further about it. Right. We're constantly looking to ensure that the audits are not, we have statutory audits, we have audits that have to be done for federal requirements, and we want to be nimble when there's something that is important to the people. And so if you become aware of something that becomes it's an issue to constituents, then, you know, we certainly will want to know about that as well. Thank you for allowing us to be here.
Thank you. I just had one more thought on the education audit idea as Representative Wisnett was talking, and that is that one of the other issue is that there's sort of duplication of areas of the grants, like CTE or grants that are supposed to help with absenteeism or grants that are supposed to help with trauma or grants that are supposed to help with high school graduation rates. And also, you know, in a performance type, you know, audit, it would seem that we should be looking at duplication and also how effective those duplications are, or if they are trying to hit a different area or a different, you know, sort of slice of the issue or the problem. But sometimes, you know, maybe it's easier or a different set of standards for those two same grants for the same purpose. And we want to make sure, again, as Representative Wisnett was saying, that we have equality of access for all schools to be able to have some opportunity for, you know, grants that deal with high school graduation or grants that deal with a CTE. And so it felt like, you know, looking at the grants that are overlapping and seeing if the access is open and helping us, you know, get to more schools or to more students across the state could be important as well.
Thank you.
Understood.
Okay. So thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
With us today. I appreciate your time and your energy
yeah.
and your comments. Okay, at this time, our second issue on our agenda today is to have the Department of Administrative Services have a discussion regarding equal pay in Oregon state government. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members. Katie Koba, State Chief Operating Officer and Director of DAS. And with me is Madeline Zeik, who's the Chief Human Resources Officer. And I'm going to turn it over to Madeline here in a minute to talk a little more in detail about kind of the current state of affairs with pay and pay equity in state government, and talk a little bit about some of the initiatives that we're planning in terms of moving forward to address the issue. But I wanted to convey the message to you, first of all, congratulations to the legislature for the work that you've done on the pay equity bill. It's a great accomplishment and I think very, very important. And the message that I wanted to share with you is how serious this is an issue for us in DAS, the issue around pay equity. It's personal for me. I think Madeline would probably share the same message. And this is something that we're committed to, and we have some work to do. There's no doubt about that, but we feel optimistic about that work and how we might move forward. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Madeline, and she's going to go through some information for you, and then obviously we're available to answer any questions that you may have. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Co-Chairs Devlin and McLean, members of the committee, I'm Madeline Zeik, and as Katie mentioned, I'm the state's Chief Human Resources Officer, and I'm located out of DAS. And as Katie also mentioned, pay equity is something that I'm very committed to and is very personal to me. I'm of a generation that this wasn't always something that was considered. So as a woman of a certain age, I am very committed to pay equity and really excited to talk to you about it today. What I thought I would do is maybe give you a high-level overview of the executive branch approach to our classification and compensation system, so I'll apologize if you've already heard this, and then go into some recommendations that we have just recently had based on some studies that we've had done. So in the executive branch, we're required to maintain a system that's internally equitable as well as market competitive. To do this, we use a classification and compensation system known as the Hays system. You may or may not have heard about it. It's been around state government for, I was checking around for people who have been here a lot longer than me. I'm thinking at least 20 years that the state's been using it. And it's also used quite extensively in the public sector. It's a structured compensation system with salary ranges and classification and compensation practices that just move forward after your entry in the system. And in your world, you may have heard about it as the step-based system. So the step-based system, I think, is often the way we talk about it here in state government. It uses the following factors to set the compensation and classification. Know-how, so you can tell how long it's been around when you have a term like know-how being used. Know-how, problem-solving, accountability, and working conditions. And so we may have job classifications that do diverse work duties, like an office assistant or a maintenance worker, that can be assigned similar salary ranges or bands based on the comparability of work and those factors. However, we also know that we haven't done a pay equity study in the state for a long time. I don't know how many years, but many years. And so in 2015, we were asked by the governor to do a pay equity study. We knew that we didn't necessarily have the resources on staff, so we contracted with Portland State University, who certainly has more data capacity than we do, to complete a pay equity study. And unlike most studies, we consider gender as well as minority status in our study. And some of you may have seen the study. We had a 2015 study, then a 2016 refresh, and I'm happy to share it with the committee later if you'd like to have it. I don't have it with me today. It's got lots of tables, charts, and graphs. One of the key limitations, though, that we found of the study in talking to PSU is we don't have data related to education education, experience, special skills, certifications, licenses centrally located. And part of the reason for that is that we have an older COBOL system that still works very well, Senator Riley, but is ready to be updated. And some of you may already have heard about the HRIS system that we're looking to have approved in our budget. That lack of that information doesn't give us the whole picture. There's some key indicators and key factors that just aren't there that we don't have. And in order to get that information, we'd need to have either some self-service in a system, which we don't, where employees would put it in themselves, or we'd have to do a survey to the 40,000 employees that we have in state government service. With the implementation of that system that's in the governor's budget, if that's approved, we'll be able to then collect that information and get have a more accurate reflection. But based on that, as Director Koba said, just based on what we had, it looked like, for example, for females, that they were only making about 88.8% of what males were making globally in our overall system as an aggregate.
And I might just interject real quickly. This new human resources information system, I think, is really critical to being able to address what does the state compensation system look like and what are some of those driving factors for why there's a disparity between pay versus different classes. So we've talked a lot about the HRIS system. We talked about it in our budget subcommittee. It is being looked upon favorably. There are a number of reasons why we need to update it. This is just one of those, but it's a pretty important reason.
Thank you. And one of the other things we found as we looked at the 2015 system is even though they have great doctoral students and researchers at PSU, our data and some of the mapping to the fields was not accurate. So we asked them then to do the refresh in 2016. And I can also send you that report. So we've got both reports if you're interested
in
those.
Could I take a question here? Would that be okay?
Sure. Absolutely.
So Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm embarrassed. I'm not really... I should know this, but I come from the Department of Defense, so we have a lot of civilians. You're calling it the STEP. So can you explain function of job or whatever? There's so many steps. Does that max out after so much, right? Because if we didn't max it out, we'd really blow the budget, right? And so can you tell me how many steps and how does that every year or how does that work?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, you're correct. I think it's very similar in some ways to the federal system. Most of our classifications have 9 steps, and so people would progress based on successful performance, but through those, and it's just about 4.86 between each step percent. Some of our classifications have a step 10, but that's based on some negotiations that have been done through the union contracts. But you're right, there's a cap really on the number of steps that an individual can go through within the process.
And thanks. Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, many state employees are topped out, meaning that they've reached the maximum step and have been in that place for many, many years. I don't know the percentage offhand. I don't know if Madeline knows it. I'm guessing, just very much a wild guess, probably about 40% of state employees would be topped out. We are definitely a longevity-based system. So if you're here over time, you progress, and then you hit the top.
Yeah. And Representative Wisnett, I think it's closer to 60% based on the last piece of information that I got.
Well, a couple of quick ones, if I can.
Yes,
thank you, Madam.
Of course.
You mentioned all the people that you're looking at, minorities and women. Do you look at people with disabilities? Is that... as far as pay equity, or how do you...
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Wisnett, that's something we would like to do, but again, that's not a data point we have available. We'll have that when we move it to the new HRIS system.
Last one, real quick.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure this is correct. You did give military preference versus disability, military preference to enter the system, right?
Representative Wisnett, yes, absolutely we do. We provide points for veterans coming into the system and also some additional points for disabled veterans, and that preference moves with them as they move through the system.
Explain that, please.
Sure. So as they apply for another position, if they're in the system and they want a promotion or they want a transfer or whatever, they're also given their preference points.
Thank you very much.
You okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this question.
Okay. So a little.
You had a question.
Did you have a question?
Oh, yes.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair.
I actually went to the hearings on the Hays system back in the mid-1980s.
So Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair was going to say it's older than 20 years because it's been here since I've been here. Dates a few of us.
What I'm wondering is, and we may be able to find states that are similar, but how common is it to have so many steps for positions, given that the reality of this is, in one sense, you're paying the same amount for the same work for a person, and that there's literally a 40% differential between bottom step or maybe even higher now. How common is it to have this many steps?
Co-Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I don't think
I
know.
I remember when we had far fewer steps than this.
Right.
Actually.
I don't think I know, but I can sure research that and get back to you. I came from Nevada, and we had a similar type process. I don't think we had as many steps, but we can sure do some research and get that back to you. Happy to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think with that, maybe I will go ahead and just walk through the PSU recommendations. There were seven of them. We agreed with the seven recommendations, and just to make it pretty clear, we let them work pretty autonomously. We were interpreting data, we were answering questions, we had a committee of state staff that they worked with, but we let them come up with the recommendations pretty much on their own. So I'll just walk through those real quick. The first one was to resolve the data gap. So as I mentioned, we've asked for the funding for HRIS because we don't have that key data set to really give us the full picture. We'll need to collect the missing data that we talked about. We still have to do that, but we should have a self-service mechanism through the new system so that we don't have to send out a lot of forms. And we'll be doing that as part of the conversion process for the system if it's approved by the legislature. And the go live for that system is somewhere between July and September of 2018. And that'll give us more information about what the real picture is. The second recommendation was to develop mentoring programs, another one I know that is dear and near to our heart. We've done some reorganization within the Chief Human Resources Office, and now we have a workforce development function, and they're developing guidelines for mentoring programs. Some agencies have had their own mentoring programs, but DAS and the CHRO has never really provided a toolkit, so we're working on that. We're finalizing an onboarding and mentoring program for key executives, starting there, and we have an internship program that begins in August, and we've really tried to focus on a diverse group of applicants within that internship program. They're going to be about 60 participants just this year. Let's see, recommendation number three is to invest in STEM outreach and education, and those are programs that I know you've heard about within your hearings here by agencies that we could certainly get more information to you, but I think agencies are working on those STEM programs, science, technology, education, math, using those acronyms. The fourth recommendation was to reduce bias in hiring. One of the things that we're doing is rolling out some cultural competency training regarding unconscious bias in hiring and also unconscious bias in the workplace. We had the governor's office brought in Policy Link out of Portland, and we had the state executive leadership, the ELT group, and I believe members of the governor's office also went through that Policy Link training. And I've been working with Serena Stoudemire-Wesley at the governor's office. We're going to try and roll that out on a more statewide basis, or at least have an electronic version of it. Also to address this, I keep mentioning that HRIS thing. Sorry, I sound like I'm making a pitch there, but I am a little bit. And then we're also getting a new recruitment system in HRIS. That's another part of the HR information system. our recruitment system, I'm not sure if you're familiar with anybody that's applied for a state job. It's really not as old as some of the others, but you still need to go in and fill out this really long job application, and you can't attach things easily, and you can't print out your application. And it's hard for us in this new modern world to be competitive when we've got a system like that. But that will also help us with some of the other things that we're going to do around removing the salary history. That's one of the things we're going to be doing as soon as this system rolls out, and I believe that's consistent with what you're planning for at the legislature. And in general, we're looking at our job recruitment process, making sure it's based on best practice, and that's part of what that workforce development group is doing, is looking at best practice, not only in the public sector, but also the private sector. Recommendation number five was to review our job evaluation system, and again, that's the HAY job evaluation system, and while I don't see us replacing that in anytime soon, it seems to be working. We have had some initiatives to look at some of our management compensation and just compensation in general and making sure that it's making sense, and so we'll be doing more of that as we move through the HRIS project. Recommendation number six was to offer family-friendly benefits. Oregon has a pretty good track record of that. We are encouraging agencies to use flexible work schedules or manage their workforce as they see appropriate, and that was one of the key recommendations in the PSU report. And number seven was to create a pay equity website, and so we're in the process of that. We expect it to probably go live early to mid-July. We'll have policies, rules, best practices, some of the online training I just talked about, those sorts of things that that articles, those toolkits that I talked about, all of those will be on our pay equity website that we're in the process of developing. That, I think, is going to be a real opportunity for us to connect with a lot of people. People are used to seeing things on a website, and they want to be able to click and be able to read what's out there about pay equity. And then we're also, that's the seven recommendations from PSU. We're moving forward on all of them. You can see some of them are further ahead than others, but those are the seven recommendations that we're working on there. And we're also waiting on final guidance on the legislation regarding pay equity so that that can guide our policy development and help us move forward. And then the longer term activity, something that I see way out there. I hope I will still be here to see it long enough. But it's the development of an analysis tool like they have in the state of Minnesota. So I know those of you that are familiar with pay equity and what they've been doing in Minnesota, they've been working on pay equity in the public sector for about 20 years. And they started at about 82% equity. And after 20 years, they're at 97.7. I'm sure they'd like to be at 100 like we would, but they're at 97.7. But what they've done is they've developed tools that not only state government can use, but also local entities for pay equity. And it's an actual, it's a math thing, but it's an actual tool where people can go in and put in information about their workforce. And I could certainly send you a link to that too. They have been one of the leaders in some of this work. And then I think that was about all I had for you today around what we're doing. That's kind of an overview of our plan and our progress. There is a lot going on. We're super excited about it. But know we also have some opportunities for improvement.
Mm-hmm. Any questions for our panel? Yes, Representative Wisden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all this information and presentation. First question is easy. Is the PSU study on OLIS? Can it be put on OLIS or submitted to this committee?
We can get it to staff.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go back to the step question about steps again. When you make a new hire, do you always start them at the first step?
Co-chairs Devlin and McLean, Representative Wisnett, we don't always start them at the same step. And that's part of the conversation that I was having about some of the information about their background, and we don't always start at the first step. For example, you were talking about military service, and we often find that our veterans come in at a little bit higher. You know, they've been in the military for a while, they have that experience, and we try and be comparable if we can, so we are not required to start them at step one. Sometimes agencies have their own budgetary constraints and their own rules about, okay, our HR department won't do anything more than a step one or two. Traditionally, people don't usually start them over a step four. That's kind of the norm, but we don't always start them at step one.
Thank you.
And I can share, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, when I was at the Department of Agriculture, if one of our managers wanted to offer higher than a step four, that had to come to the director for approval, and that did require documentation Good. About why they deserve something higher than a step four.
If the two chairs will let me expand a little bit about beyond, since we have this expertise in equal pay, does DAS look at the Manning documents and look at span of control? Do you look at, you know, we have the one bill that was passed some time ago, which I actually sponsored with SEIU, the span of control bill. I know we had problems with that, and we got it back, and we got it changed again. Do you look at that when you're looking at, you know, does the HR department head, you're, you know, looking at organizations of how they're organized and how many slots they have in spaces?
So, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, I can answer from a broad perspective, and then if Madeline has anything to add to it, we'll certainly let her do that. The requirement around span of control really falls on agencies to manage. So coming from Department of Agriculture, you know, we had to track that span of control and move that step increment each year. If you were not at that time, if you were not at the 1 to 11 management to staff ratio and you wanted to hire a manager, then you needed to go to DAS to get approval to do that. And then, of course, there was the reporting requirement back to the legislature. So DAS, in terms of day in and day out, is not micromanaging agencies to make sure they're meeting that span of control requirement. But I can tell you agencies were taking it very very seriously, and then they're required to report to DAS their progress. So I think at Ag we had started at 1 to 8 maybe and had made it to 1 to 10, and we're really beginning to run into some difficulties in trying to get to the next level. And so the joint work with the unions and our shop in terms of bringing the bill forward that you all are now considering has
Thank you.
Been very helpful.
Along that same line, Madam Chair,
yes, absolutely.
Do you look at deputies? I know in the military that we tried to eliminate deputies. Do you have a rule, or is there a policy as far as deputies? How many you have to supervise to have a deputy? Or
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, again, we rely on agencies to figure out what is the structure that makes best sense in their agency. And we went through some different iterations at the Department of Ag. I know in talking to agency directors now, some have a deputy, some don't. Some have a deputy assistant director model. Some have a director, multiple assistant directors. And I think it really needs to be driven by the business of the agency and how best to meet those business needs, recognizing that with the span of control legislation and even with the new legislation, there are limits in terms of the number of managers. So it's really trying to figure out what the business is of the agency, where you have your managers, and where, if you need to adjust that structure.
Colleagues at this table, the co-chairs of Ways and Means, I know for several sessions I've worked on vacant positions. Mm-hmm. And I have had a bill a couple of sessions drafted with DAS support and LFO that does establish a program for removing vacant positions over 6 months, but not fully justified. This doesn't look good if we got so many vacant positions, and you know that's a cost driver. It's a cost driver. Each person is $200,000. We start looking at Ways and Means that we have to figure in. Do you see any solutions, or do you have any suggestions? You've said, Director, and I respect you a lot, but you know that a lot of this done defer to the agencies, but we depend upon you to be our CFO and our COO.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think you and I could spend a whole day talking about vacant positions and management philosophy. And again, it is so dependent on function of the agency. So I'll give you an example of, again, when I was at the Department of Agriculture. We have a number of programs at the Department of Agriculture that are other fund supported. So they're supported by fee payers. And we would have business cycles that were not always the same every year. And so it didn't always make sense to fill those positions. We would assess what the need was in terms to meet our customer needs. And the good thing about other funded positions, if we're not filling those positions, then that fee revenue doesn't need to be raised perhaps as soon as it would need to be otherwise. From a general fund perspective, I can tell you that as an agency director, if I'm anticipating a budget shortfall coming, I know that positions in my agency are going to be looked at to be cut. And from a management perspective, if I have someone that leaves a position 8 months out before the legislature is going to meet and look at these issues, I don't want to fill that position with the potential of turning around and looking at a cut from a legislative action. So sometimes, believe it or not, agencies are anticipating in terms of what they know is coming from a budget shortfall and knowing that they're going to be looking at eliminating positions, and it doesn't make sense to fill those. We have historically over time given vacancy reports to the legislature, and the legislature has taken vacant positions, and I've been a recipient of that. So from my own personal opinion, can the process be improved? Always. You can always improve that process. But I would say I don't think we're that broken in terms of how we're managing vacancies in state government. I think it's a very fluid and dynamic process. I think for people on the outside that don't understand that, it doesn't make any sense to them. I think for those of us on the inside trying to manage it, it does make sense from a management perspective. But it's trying to explain to your constituent, Joe Smith, it's a very difficult thing to do.
I'm sorry, I've got one more question.
One more question.
Thank you for that information, Director, and we could talk about it a long time. In the Ways and Means Subcommittees, I don't know if my colleagues beside the two co-chairs, that when we asked the agencies to come in with reductions, and I think every agency that testified in my subcommittee I serve on came in with their solution was to go from 60 days of filling a vacant position to 120. I don't see that as, I mean, if you either 4 months you don't need the position, that's one third of the budget. That's, you know, what is that, $30,000 or more, $60,000. But they told me that was their normal process to fill a position 60 days it takes. But they were going to extend it, and that was going to be a reduction to extend it to four months. That doesn't make sense. I don't think that was a real cost savings or a driver. But,
were you asking it in the form of a question? So I can ask her if she wants to respond.
I'll just make it as a comment, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions for our panel?
Yeah, I want to know if Representative Wisnett has more that he's just holding back.
Are you holding back?
You know, this is... may I comment?
Absolutely.
I thank the Senator. We're all looking at cost drivers. We're all talking about PERS reductions, and we can't do that. The only way we're going to cut down some of the cost drivers is to cut the size of our state government. And I know that's difficult on agencies, but I've been in the military for 27 years. We'd take 10% cut, 5% cut, years after years. But because we can't solve, the courts aren't going to allow us to solve PERS.
That's right.
We're stuck with it. We made those decisions. We have to live with those decisions. And so we have to look at each person's $200,000 a budget. Most of them, sir. That's an average. Good. You tell that's a good average, I think, Mr. Kocher. But so we have to look at each person, each position, to try to find some ways to reduce the cost. Thank you. That's my. I could go on. We'll do the director, and I'll have to do that with a beer. So.
So other questions or comments? Anybody have a comment they'd like to make? Well, I appreciate the information, and I really appreciated you giving us the sample of the 7 recommendations, and you gave us a good idea of where you were on each one of them. Do you have an estimate on how long it will take to finish getting through the list of 7?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I don't yet. For some of them, I do. You know, for example, taking the salary history field off, we're thinking middle of July. The HRIS system, if it's approved, you know, about 15 months once we start. But we could sure get that to you with some timelines. I can check with staff and try and get some more firm timelines for you and get it with maybe those other reports that sound like you were maybe interested in.
I know you deal with performance measures, you know, in the budget process, and I think that if folks had a ability to try and, you know, give that kind of information, that you would get some really good points on getting through the performance measures that they want you to improve. But I would appreciate it if you could.
Certainly.
Yes, Senator Riley.
So I just wanted to ask the cost of the HRIS system that you're talking about.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Riley, the cost of the HRIS system is right around, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but right around $18.5 million for the initial implementation. And then after the 15-month implementation, it's about $2.5 million of ongoing costs because we're it's a software as a service, so we're buying the license or the subscription, whatever we like to call it.
Great. Thank you.
It's off the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank you both for coming today, and I appreciate the information you were able to share. And I know that Representative Wisnett gave you a lot to think about, and I know we'll continue this conversation as we go forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So are there other issues that are for the good of the order?
The only thing, Madam Chair, I'd like to point out is we did attach the, as we said we would, the tracker will be on there every time, and you will notice on the tracker there is a new item on there. There's also the attached letter that came from Senator Boquist regarding a request to have various elements of the Department of Transportation be subject to an audit. So the committee doesn't need to do anything today, but it's on there for your review so that when we come back in 2 weeks, we can decide whether you want to assign that or, again, request Secretary of State to do that or LPRO or otherwise deal with that item. So give you a chance to look at that. But just wanted to make you aware it's out there.
Well, thank you all for being here today. And if there's no other business, then we'll adjourn the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits for May 30th. Okay. On Legislative Audits for May 30th.